This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is August 8th in the year 2001. I'm in the reading room at Steenbach Library with Omai Garner, who's been a scholar in the Chancellor's Scholarship Program since, when did you come?
1996.
Mm-hmm. Before we get to the program, though, you had a life before you came to Madison. Why don't you talk a little bit about your background, a little bit about your family, your early schooling years?
Okay. I grew up in Racine, Wisconsin, mm-hmm. which is 20 minutes south of Milwaukee. It's a rather large town as far as towns in mm-hmm. Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. It has about 100,000 people. I come from a mixed family where my dad is black and my mom's white. And growing up in the late 70s, early 80s, it was clear that I was growing up in a mixed family as far as the reactions from other people.
Like
you get stared at walking through the malls and things like that. Now that's different now, but I distinctly remember that as an early
child. Is that different because you're in Madison, or is that just sort of different generally?
I think that's just different nationwide now. The attitude towards mixed relationships are, when you see a couple together with a child and they're mixed, it's not the same kind of looks. Yeah, it's not the same kind of taken aback look that I would have gotten when I was younger. I went to public elementary school and public middle school, very large institutions. Like, my public middle school had 2,000 kids for three grades. And then when I was going to high school, my dad is a high school band teacher. Hmm. And the high school that was in my home region or my neighborhood was J.I. Case High School in Racine. And at the time that I was entering in 1992, they actually had a number of race riots that went on within the school.
And what were the race riots about?
Racine had a large gang population because it's directly between Milwaukee and Chicago,
right,
and less than an hour distance from either town. And there's about 40% black population in Racine, mm-hmm. so it's large, especially mm-hmm. for Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a skinhead population also living in the town.
Uh-oh.
And so they were all going to high school together, and it was just the beginning of when they started needing metal detectors in schools,
and that whole
jump start to that. And so I went to the private high school in town. I went to the Prairie School. And there, my graduating class was 35 people.
Hmm.
And so it was very, very small. In fact,
different.
the whole high school only had 150 people in it total. And it was college preparatory high school, where you go through your classes, and there wasn't anything real special curriculum-wise.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I know, talking with kids now, they have choices that they can take, like a business class mm-hmm. in their ninth grade year. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have nothing like that. Yeah, it was very standard. But they offered AP classes in the sciences, which was very interesting.
AP means
advanced placement classes where you can get credit for college. And the teachers were all, the classrooms were really small. We had like 10 or 15 people in every class. Mm. It was a lot of hands-on work, if you had trouble with something, you could always be with mm-hmm. the teacher mm-hmm. by mm-hmm. yourself mm-hmm. after school and spend as much time as you need finishing things out. And I was there, until 1996.
Now let's stop there for a second. You said there was a more traditional curriculum. Did you mind that?
Did you
know that other things existed out there?
I was unaware, and I think this might be a more of a recent thing, because I just talked with that camp job. I also mm-hmm. had high school students mm-hmm. for a little while, and they were talking about how the range of classes that they could take, like they could take a microbiology course mm-hmm. their ninth or tenth grade
wow.
year. And that's, I mean, I was just doing regular bio. The curriculum was just like you go through bio 1, bio 2, and then you have a choice. You want to do AP bio or AP chemistry. And so the options, there weren't a lot of options, but it wasn't like when you came to the Prairie School, they guaranteed that you get into college.
Right.
But they expected you to go. There was never a question of what you would do after high school. You were going on to some higher institution. It's just where it would be or where would you go.
Where did you find yourself gravitating to in terms of courses? What courses did you like to find
biology.
Most intriguing? Biology.
Yeah, and that was also, the biology teacher was my golf coach.
Mm.
And so I had that relationship with him as well as being my mm-hmm. biology teacher. And so he made the classes. He was a great teacher.
Mm-hmm.
He made the classes a lot of fun. We did a lot of hands-on things in mm-hmm. class. And so for a 14, 15, 16-year-old.
That's great. Yeah.
Excited me about biology, mm-hmm. which was good.
Yeah.
The physics teacher was kind of boring, and I don't really like physics, so I don't know if that's...
You wonder how much that really does affect
how much
you, know, because the teacher really is important. Yeah. They can inspire you. So, you graduated with the intention of going on to college.
Yes.
What about your parents? Had your dad had obviously gone on to college because he was teaching. Mm-hmm. Your mother also?
Yeah, she's also, she's an elementary teacher.
Oh.
And they both actually, well, by the time I finished high school, my mom had her master's degree in teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And then 2 years into college, my dad had his master's degree in education.
Oh.
And so they both have gone on past the undergraduate level. Let's see, my dad went to University of Arkansas, Little Rock, Pine Bluff.
I've heard
and my mom went to Western Michigan.
Mm.
And so there really wasn't, I was going to college.
Yeah, you there was not good about it.
No,
do you have any sibs?
I do. I have four half-brothers and sisters from my dad's first marriage. And two of them went to college.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, two of them went to college. One's in the Navy. The other works for the airplane industry.
Okay, now you're a lifelong resident of Racine?
I was born actually in South Bend, Indiana.
South Bend, Indiana.
Yeah,
and
that's
you,
where they're all from. All
and you, but you spent most of your life, relatively speaking.
I was less than a year old when
So Racine was your home and Wisconsin was your home state.
Yeah.
When it came time to start thinking about college, that would be when? The spring of your senior year, something like that? What thoughts were you going through and what were you sending out for and getting letters from and things like that?
I wanted to, I scored well on my placement exams into college, so the letters were piling.
The letters came.
Yeah, so the letters came, and I knew that I could get into Madison, and that I could go here, and that the amount of money it took to go here would not break the bank, so to say. You know what I mean?
Right.
So that was my
my
safe school, so to say, was an excellent school. It was one of the better schools in the nation. So that was good. So then I wanted to. I had this goal of moving away from Wisconsin, just because I'm not a cold weather fan, and a number of other reasons.
Yeah.
The weather is a major important factor. And so I applied to Stanford, and I applied to Brown, Northwestern, which is fairly close still, and Yale. And so after receiving, I got into Stanford, and I got into Brown, and I got into Northwestern, but then I didn't get into Yale. And they... While we were going through the process of communicating with these universities, it sounded like they were going to offer me a lot of money to go. Like, it sounded like their deal was going to be pretty good, but when they actually laid it down on paper, they still wanted $15,000 to $18,000 a year to go to college.
Oh,
now,
yes.
Out of a $35,000-$40,000 a year tuition and housing package, it's not a bad deal that they're giving me. They're giving me a lot of money. But then, and I can't remember exactly what month it was that Mercil called.
Mercil Lee we're talking
about. Mercil called my house, and I had filled out, my college counselor had given me this brochure about the Chancellor Scholarship Program. I took it home, talked it over with my parents. They were like, yeah, you know, fill it out, who knows, maybe you won't have to pay tuition, and that'll be another option in choosing a university. So I filled it out, and she called, and she offered me this free ride tuition to Madison, and talked about the other incentives of the program. I listened to what she said about the other incentives of the program, but I didn't really hear. You know, I didn't really hear what she said.
Yeah.
I just more heard free tuition.
Yeah.
When I compared the free tuition package of UW-Madison with $18,000 to $20,000 a year going to either Stanford or Brown or Northwestern, I really couldn't, because it wasn't going to be my burden. I wasn't going to take, my parents would have taken out the loans for that. For my undergraduate,
that's a lot of money.
Yeah, and I didn't. And it was going to end up being around $100,000 that I put myself and them into debt for my undergraduate degree. And I knew, I didn't know. I thought I wanted to be a medical doctor. So I knew I wanted to go on to some kind of schooling
afterwards.
My undergraduate. Well, then that would have been more debt
even
piled on top of
schools,
And so I thought, it was a pretty quick decision. I was like, the next day I woke up and said I was going to Madison.
Did you visit Madison at all? When you talked to Mercil, you said you were listening, but you weren't hearing.
Mm-hmm.
What was your initial impression of Mercil over the phone? Do you remember that?
It was a long time ago. She really wanted me to go to school there, and I presented her. I told her about the other programs that I had gotten into and what they were offering, and she really tried to draw me into Madison on the idea of our biology program,
mm-hmm.
on the idea of our medical school, and on the idea of not collecting debt,
mm-hmm.
as
mm-hmm.
an undergraduate, mm-hmm. which is mm-hmm. important. And then she also tried to stress to me the need for African-American males at the university, mm-hmm. whereas especially when I entered in 1996, the numbers were really low. And so she was pushing those sort of angles onto me, and they worked.
They worked.
They worked.
Yeah. So when you came to Madison in the fall for orientation, you had not visited it?
Well, I hadn't officially... Well, yeah, I went to SOAR.
Oh,
so
you
I did
SOAR.
The, yeah, I did okay. the over the summer tour and
now
stay
the,
for a couple days and things like that.
The SOAR was just for the general freshman population.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't specifically
yeah,
for the chancellors.
Yeah, it was the whole freshman population. And that was fun because I had never been in Madison alone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I had been there, and we would come all the time for tennis tournaments or, like, things
right.
of that effect. We would wind up in Madison a lot, but it was never on my own as an 18-year-old, like, kind
and
of
knowing you were going
freedom.
To be
yeah,
there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And knowing that the next year or for the next 4 or 5 years, this was going to be
yeah.
my home. And so,
what was your impression of the campus on this visit?
The campus I thought was huge. The only campus I had really been on was UW Parkside,
yeah.
and I had taken
yeah.
yeah just some courses out there in high school, and so it was really different as far as the stretch from one end of the campus to another. And I couldn't even believe like how big just the engineering section was. And all of a sudden, we're going all the way to the other end, all the way to humanities. I was lost. I didn't really know what was going on. It's just the size was pretty overwhelming,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't get to experience the amount of people there at SOAR, because
mm-hmm.
there were a lot of SOAR kids with me,
mm-hmm.
but there were like 40,000, you know, there was like probably 400 or 500 SOAR kids with me and my group, so it was large. But then when we first came, there was that opening week pep rally sort of thing,
yeah.
where you go down to the field house, and they pack in all the freshmen, and you look around, and you see that you're a member of a class of
yeah.
5,000 or 6,000
yeah.
people, and that was pretty overwhelming,
yeah.
seeing all the people.
I bet it was. Yeah. When you came here, when did you first come together as a group, the Chancellor Scholarship Program?
It was, I would say it was the third day that I was here. It was really early on in the first week.
Mm-hmm.
We had our freshman meeting, and it was before classes started, and we all went into the office and went into a conference room, and I met Marcille for the first
mm-hmm.
time, and I saw the other members of my Chancellor Scholarship
mm-hmm.
class. And that was great, because initially coming to Madison, especially with freshman orientation and living in, like, I lived in the dorms. I lived
mm-hmm.
in Crossage over at Lakeshore
mm-hmm.
and out of a 78-person dorm, and then also, like, there's 3 or 4 of those around. I was the only black face
mm-hmm.
in that whole area. And so that was different from Racine.
Yes,
that's
it was.
A lot different
that's
from Racine.
That
was a lot different from being with my father
yeah.
every day. You know,
yeah.
I was taken aback, but then I go into this room, this Chancellor Scholars room, and the diversity around the table was just phenomenal. All different sorts of races, women and men, and it was, that took me aback a little bit. I didn't know the Chancellor Scholarship Program was going to be like that. I wasn't aware that it was going to be this hugely diverse group of people. I didn't know exactly who it was for
yeah.
and things like that, so I didn't know who was going to be in the room.
That's great.
And that was wonderful.
Yeah. How many people were in your freshman group? Do you remember? About
25. Yeah, right around there, maybe 23.
And Marcille ran the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And,
Marcille ran the meeting.
What did she tell you at that point? Do you recall? I know that was a while ago.
Don't get overwhelmed with the size of the university. Study hard, and you will be seeing a lot of me. That's what she said. You will see a lot of me. And it was hard because Marcille, at least from this initial impression, she holds herself like, I'm not saying she holds herself in high regard, but like she has an esteem about her
mm-hmm.
as a professional woman in the university
oh, yes.
that can be intimidating to
mm-hmm.
a freshman. It's the same way that I feel approaching a professor or
mm-hmm.
talking to the
mm-hmm.
chancellor. You know, I mean, Marcille means business in
yeah.
the room, and she lets you know
yeah.
that she means business. But it's always, and I initially got this, that it's always to a point where she really cares about your well-being.
Yeah.
Like she really wants to know, and she knew us by name, and I mean, we didn't know anybody else's name. She knew who we were. She knew information about us. She
mm-hmm.
had some knowledge about what was going on with us, where we wanted to go. And this is like the third day.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And she had an idea about what each person was going to do. And I didn't know this three or four years down the road mm-hmm. is when I started to learn more about Mercia.
Yeah, we'll talk about her when we summer later on. Did you have any get-togethers with? Did you get to meet the rest of the scholars?
Yeah, right away in early September, I think it's the first Sunday in September, we have a Chancellor Scholars Picnic. And that's where everybody gets together and all the mentors and all the scholars with Mercio, and we have a picnic out at Rennebaum Park and play games. I mean, it's really laid back. There's nothing academic about it. It's more, especially that first day, that's where you first meet your mentor too. Like, you're supposed to have contacted that person over the phone, and then they pick you up by car and take you out for the first time. And so Paul Barrows was my mentor, and he
did he remain your mentor through
the whole time, and he picked me up. And we went out there, and it was the first university professional black man that I had ever been in contact with at all. And so it was an immediate role model that Mercile set up for me. Like, from the get-go, it was an immediate role model through Paul. And we talked at the meeting. I kind of told him what I wanted to do, what I saw myself doing. He had some ideas about... And he had specific ideas about what classes I could take and things like that, but he knew some names of professors that I could talk to in different areas, and I didn't take advantage of it as a freshman, but as we moved it became very important.
Tell me what, you've had a chance, you've had this relationship with Paul for, 5 years now. What is it? What is he? Is he your friend? Is he your counselor, advisor? What is the role of the mentor?
It's
at least at the role of Paul with you, not necessarily everyone.
With Paul and I, it took me 2.5 to 3 years to start calling him Paul. Because I come in as an 18-year-old.
Sure,
and
that's a hard thing.
I'm Mr. Barrows, I'm Miss Lee, and right away Mercile cut that off. She's like, no, call me Mercile. But I called Mr. Barrows, I called Paul Mr. Barrows right away, and he didn't stop me from doing that. But when Mercile heard me doing that, she's like, no, call him Paul. So she wanted the relationship, which I understand. She wanted the relationship to be a face-to-face, adult, working relationship, whereas I saw the relationship as, this is my mentor. And I always feel like mentor means, like, aged, wiser, has more experience, someone to hold in a position of respect. And so I would say Mr. Barrows.
Right. Well, isn't that what we're taught?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Especially coming out of high school as an 18-year-old, I would call him Mr. Barrows. But as the years progressed and we met more and more and talked more and more, I don't know when it slipped into Paul, but it's been Paul all the way out.
Well, the fact that you can't remember means it was just sort of a natural thing.
Yeah, just kind of slid right into it.
And what do you do with Paul? I mean, do you just stop in and see him? Do you guys go to ball games together?
So you need to have, Mercia requires that you have lunch or dinner or some kind of meal with your mentor twice a year. So that's not a lot of contact.
No, that isn't.
And just once a semester. But in setting that up, it takes a couple times. Especially with Paul, because as Paul's job description changed dramatically while I had my tenure with him here, it would become towards the end harder and harder to set up meetings with him because Project 2008 and things of that effect. Things that he was
very
working on. He was very, very busy. But in the early days, I could just go into his office and he would usually be there. We'd sit down and chat for 5 minutes and set up a lunch. And then we'd go, lunch would be the next week. And we'd have lunch probably two or three times a semester. It wasn't once a semester. And he would tell me things about, it was mainly connector things. He would tell me things about who I need to go see if I had a specific problem. So I would come to him and say, I'm having trouble in chemistry, and I really don't know where to go, because the size of UW-Madison makes it so that there are things to help all students here, but they don't tell you about them. You need to be proactive and go find them. For a freshman, especially for a minority freshman coming to this school, that can be a very intimidating process to do, like to just go into the Chemistry Learning Center. So he would tell me the name of someone in the Chemistry Learning Center that I could ask for and say, hello, I know Paul. I know Paul Barrows. He said,
Mr. Barrows.
At that time, it was definitely Mr. Barrows. I should come in and see this person, and they would help me out. And so that track was made things a lot easier, especially through Paul in the early days.
So in your opinion, the mentor thing did what it should
have
been. It was a very comfortable relationship.
And far and beyond. Like, it didn't even... That freshman and sophomore year, He needed a tutor for his daughter. His daughter was a ninth grader, and she was having trouble in algebra. I'm fairly strong in math. And I was like, I can tutor, you know? And that gave me experience doing things like that and working with a one-on-one tutoring basis, which helped me with interpersonal skills, you know, and helped me to teach, to learn how to teach. Because I want to be a professor. And so that sort of interaction was helpful to me. And then we go to the game sometimes. We go to basketball games sometimes. Cause he'd always, but like if he had tickets, he didn't need them. He was like, oh my, you know, do you need some tickets to the basketball game?
Oh, that's nice.
Of course,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, that's great. Let's talk about academics for a little bit. You came here wanting to be a medical doctor. How did your academic career unfold during the course of your stay here?
I was sure coming in that I was going to be a medical doctor.
Did you know any doctors that this was just something that you were sure you were going to do?
We talked about it with my parents. They're like, what do you want to do? You're going to college. And I knew I loved biology. There was no, I knew the science that I liked. I just didn't know what to do with it. And in fact, the only thing I thought you could do with it was be a medical doctor. Things like PhD, master's degrees, I had no idea. I had never even heard of, I mean, I had heard of them, and they had this some sort of like mystic meaning to them, but what it meant to get one and how to go about getting one, what it means when you have one, all of that didn't mean anything to me. I was like, let me go to medical school, you know, and I know what that means. I know what that takes. And then in my first, not my first year, but probably that first semester of my second year and into the second semester, the grades that I was putting up were hindering me from going to medical school. And that's not to say I was getting bad grades, because Mercil, she demands a 3.0 or above. That's what you need to get to maintain your scholarship. That's what I was getting. And I wasn't putting in any sort of extra effort to like jump forward and get an A, especially since I really didn't like my introductory courses. Like introductory chemistry really didn't interest me at all. Even introductory biology, it seemed like a lot of my first year was a repeat of what I had done
in high school,
my senior year in high school. And so I was taking the same classes again, and I was of the attitude of, I'm taking the same classes again and I know the material, why really study? You know, what would the studying be for? So I wasn't pushing for an A in any of that area. Well, now I am 40 credits in of a 3.2 or something to that effect. And when you start to do the math, like right around the end of freshman, sophomore year, you get these little, like I went to workshops, I went to things where, like Ahana, and things where they would tell you what you needed to get into medical school, and I'd get these pieces of paper that would have a worksheet on it to figure out your GPA towards the end and what you needed to get around that like 3.7, 3.8 range. And I had already almost shot myself in the foot for that.
Right.
Now I knew that that's not the only thing that gets you into medical school. You know, and I knew that there are other factors, but I was probably fairly naive about it, that I thought grades were the only thing that really mattered to get into medical school. And so I brought this information to Mercil, and I said to her, this was my first semester sophomore year. I said to her, I want to be a medical doctor. And she looked at me, and then she looked at the grades I had been getting, and she said, you know, I don't think you want to be a medical doctor. Now, I'm 19, and I was upset. Because the last 2 years of planning in my head, because I was still like, oh, whatever, I have a 3.2, I can still do it.
Yeah.
And she just like brought the hammer down, you know, just like, you don't want to be a medical doctor. Look me right in the eyes. You don't want to be a medical doctor. I was floored. I was upset. I left her office angry that day because she had said that. And I went back the next week and had another meeting with her. And she said, have you thought about getting your PhD? And I was like, I don't even know what that means.
Yeah.
You know, what does getting my PhD mean? And she said, why don't you talk to Paul about it? Because Paul knows a different, more professors in the biomedical sciences area or the biology area that you could go talk to and specifically ask some questions about what it means to get your PhD and what do you do when you have a PhD. Because what I thought was that when you become a professor in biological sciences, you teach. That's all that you do is you teach. The whole research component was lost to me as a sophomore. I didn't even know that went on. And so the end of that sophomore year, the end of the freshman year, I went home and worked some manual labor job. And then the end of my sophomore year, I decided I was gonna stay in Madison, but I didn't know what I was gonna do. And Paul Barrows gave me this brochure of grants you can apply for summer internships or summer research scholarships. And it was paying better money than the moving company was paying. Mm. So I perked up a little bit.
Yeah,
I was like, well, what does this mean? What do I do? And so Paul had me go talk to Paul Burdick, Dr. Burdick in biomolecular chemistry, he's a tenured professor who has his lab. He's had his lab set up for a while now. And I went in there and asked him if he would like to take me on in the summer program where, I believe it was the McNair program, the Ronald McNair program for minorities in PhD positions, who would pay for it. Mm. So that's where the grant money was coming from, but I would work in Paul's lab. Mm-hmm. And that is what defined my academic career for the rest of the way out. My summer after sophomore year and having that research experience in that lab, because as far as I had known before that, the only labs that I had really done were Chemistry 104 labs. You know, and it's
what were you doing? What kind of work were you doing in the lab?
I didn't go in with really any knowledge. Like,
right.
I had a basic biology knowledge, but things like biomolecular chemistry, that whole word, I didn't even know what that word meant at all.
It's a long word.
Yeah, exactly. I had no idea. And things they would take for granted in the lab, like you know what a protein is, you know what's going on. You know what signal transduction is. There's always this mystery that whole summer. What is signal transduction? I never could quite figure it out. And he set me up with a graduate student, Phil Fassett. And every day I would come in, and Phil was a late riser. So I learned that right away about graduate school. You don't have to be an early riser. I liked
that's
that.
Good.
Yeah, I liked that. And I come in at 11, and I would stay till about 6 every day. And from 11 to 6, I would work on this project where the basics behind it, the basic knowledge behind the way the experiments would run and what was happening, I had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
He would explain it to me, and I would look, and I would watch, and I would nod my head. And I would say, he'd say, you get it? And I'd say, yes. And just an outright lie. But I figured I'd pick it up.
Yeah.
I figured eventually, and by the end of the summer, I knew what I was doing. But I did this project where I tested, without going into it with too much detail.
Just the general idea.
Yeah, we were just running Western blots that separate protein by size and looking for a specific protein. And at the end of the summer, I found it.
Hmm.
Like, I found what I was looking for, and it was just like eureka sort of explosion in
eureka
my head.
Eureka moment. That's what they
because
say.
Because I was 9 weeks into the program when it actually worked for the first time. And so this is 8 solid weeks of failure. And the Western blot it's a two-day experiment that has a number of steps where anything could go wrong through the whole time period. And when I finally did it at the end, I was like, if this is the kind of joy I can have in a research lab, you know, maybe this is something I want to do. So I started to look into, well, how does this pay? You know, and things like that. Questions where, what does your job requirement mean? So I sat down with Paul, and I said, well, what does it mean to get your PhD? Paul Burdick. And I said, well, what does it mean to get your PhD? What's the kind of work like? Because I was working, Phil was a graduate student, and I saw his project and what he was doing. And they would make me present at lab meeting, which scared me silly the first time that
team.
I did
you're
it.
Part
yeah,
of the research
I was
group.
Part of the research group, and I had to present and help
great
people
experience.
With their slides and things like that. Yeah, and as a sophomore, at the end of my sophomore year, it prepared me now to be able to go into graduate school with a leg up.
Well, you were doing what graduate students do.
Yeah, exactly.
I've sat in on some of those research groups, and that's a very intimidating experience.
It was nerve-wracking, especially since the person who went up before me the first time I went just got grilled. Like, even like, and Paul, there's the hierarchy, as in the lab, goes Paul, who's the head. He's a tenured professor, and then there's an assistant scientist below him, Greg, and then the postdocs, and then the graduate students.
Mm-hmm.
And Greg was just absolutely destroying this woman up there. And not destroying her. I misunderstood right away.
Right.
But the way I thought it sounded, because he was asking all these hard questions, and some of them she didn't have the answer to, and she was getting a little flustered, but that was because she's not good at public speaking, not because she didn't know what she wanted to say. I didn't want to go up there. You know, afterwards, I was like,
bet you didn't.
I have to go up and say something and talk to these people about a project they know so much about and I know so little about. But it wasn't anything.
Of course,
they
wanted to help you
exactly.
along.
Exactly. They were very, very helpful. They told me things that if I'm going to be giving a scientific explanation or presenting a research project, there are key terms I can't use, like prove and like
Great.
Maybe. Like, you know, yeah. there are...
Oh, those are wonderful
lessons.
There are
things where this is the truth. You can't say truth in scientific exploration because you don't know what's going to happen. And so it was that experience that sophomore year. And then for the subsequent time I was at the university, I worked in Paul's lab.
The whole time. Great.
Yeah, all the way through.
You mean during the academic year and
during
summers?
The academic year and during the summers. And I would get paid to work in the lab during the academic... No, I would get credit to work in the lab during the academic years, and then paid over the summertime to continue my projects. And so I took this project, and it wasn't the original one I started with as a sophomore year, but as a junior I took on a new project in the same area and took it on through 3 years of research, which was, I didn't get a paper out, but that experience alone got me into almost any graduate school I wanted.
Well, now you know what it takes to write a paper and all that kind of stuff, and because you've been through that. That's
it was
great.
That connection from Murcio to my mentor, Paul Barros, to my other mentor, Paul Burdix, in the scientific community that defined my academic career at UW.
So it worked.
Oh, I couldn't have asked for anything more.
In terms of the Chancellor's Scholarship Program, in the academic aspect, did you guys do tutoring? Did you get together in that? Was that part of... tell me about that.
We would, once a month, we would have a monthly meeting with all the Chancellor Scholars, and then also once a month, we'd have a monthly meeting with just your class. But during the large group meetings, people would bring in people from the writing workshop.
Marcel would bring in people from the writing center, from the chemistry labs, and that you do.
They would pass out brochures, basically.
And inform you of the services that were
Inform you of the services that were available, and that they were also looking for people to work in these positions. Mm-hmm. And so not only could you go and get help there, you could also maybe go and get a job there, which is, I mean, it's important to have. Money is an important thing. That's kind of underrides the college experience, that you need to have some sort of steady balance going on to, like, eat and pay for rent and, you know, just like things of that effect. So that was great. And then while I was a junior, they developed a program, and it was sort of a scholars helping scholars kind of program. You pass around a sheet during the monthly meeting, and you just write down what you're good at. So just write down a class and write down your name, whether you're good at it or you need help at it. You do that whole thing, and then one person would organize and connect people who needed help with each other.
And did you get to work with people?
No, I didn't get to work with anybody in that. Okay. But by the time that it was fully installed, like, the classes people needed help with, like organic chemistry, like, there are major chunks of defining classes that people need help with to get over the barrier. And they were like organic chemistry, and they were like physics,
statistics,
and things like that. Statistics classes. And I mean, I took organic chemistry as a first semester sophomore, and I didn't do very well in the class both times, you know. And so that wasn't the things I could help with. The things I could help with was like genetics 466, you know what I mean? And the classes I was taking now were like bacteriology 512. Well, no one's in bacteriology 512 in the Chancellor Scholarship Program except for me, you know. And so that sort of, I didn't really get to get involved in that.
What did you end up majoring in?
Genetics and bacteriology, double major.
Who did you work with in genetics? Or to take classes?
Yeah, I only took the classes, the class schedule all the way through. My best experience in genetics as a whole was my 566 class, which they call the capstone. The capstone's the last class that you take, and it was with Kathy Barton. And all we would do, not very many people graduated with genetics degree every year, so like it was a class of 40, and that was all the graduating people in genetics that year. And we would do paper reading. So every day, she would bring in a new paper on a new topic in genetics, and it was just scientific papers, so like seven pages long of words that are ridiculously long with all these things that you need to look up to understand what was going on, but that is also something that fuels you for graduate school, because that's what you have to, I mean, reading scientific papers is the basis of graduate education, and so you have to know what's going on. And she really, and she made us present as well, and that was something I was already good at through my lab experience. But the process of reading different papers in a lot of different areas in genetics really helped.
That's great. What about, let's talk about the social aspects of the Chancellor Scholarship Program. How often, you said you got together a couple months for these meetings and things like that, and that was kind of social and academic at the same time?
It was less academic than it was social, because
we would get through the academic stuff, and then Marcia would talk for a little bit. The academic stuff, like the brochures and people helping, and then Marcia would talk for a little bit about, in general, program notes. It's good that people are keeping up. Tell who's on the dean's list, you know, things like that. And then we would have an informal speaker come in for a fireside chat. And this, that part of the monthly meeting, really, I felt connected to the university after that part came in, because the chancellor would come in. David Ward would come speak to us annually, once a year. And then we'd always have Provost Wiley in, who's now Chancellor Wiley.
Right.
So I got to develop a relationship where I felt like I knew these two men who were in the upper echelon of the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
They weren't in. They were the upper echelon.
Exactly. And I knew that my roommates never got that experience. Yeah, right. You know, none of the people in my classes never got to actually do this and talk to them about higher education. And so that gave me a chance, especially, I don't know if I'd say I had more fire when I was 18 or 19 year olds, or I was more unrealistic about the changings that could go on in the university, but we got the opportunity to question these guys on policy. Like, I got to ask the chancellor, why aren't there more black people at this university? You know, and I got to present him questions like that to see how he would field them back to me, and he would do that in a way that was truly impressive, you know? It gave me respect for the people who were running the university, and knowledge that they were aware of what was going on. They were aware of the problems, and things were trying to change.
What did the chancellor say when you asked him? Which chancellor?
Oh, it was Chancellor Ward. Okay. And he gave me a metaphor that was like, because what I felt as an 18-year-old, I said, well, if you want 5,000 more black students, go offer them all scholarships and get them here. You know what I mean? Like, it's real cut and dry to me when I was 18. Just go get them. You know, you're the chancellor. Just go get them. It's as simple as that. And I didn't know about things like retention and like all of those other different areas that go into maintaining a high diverse population in a state that doesn't have a high diverse population, you know? And he said it was like turning a battleship. And in turning a battleship, things go very, very slowly, because you've been going one direction for such a long time. And he said, but we are turning the battleship. And so,
did you ever talk about these kinds of issues with Paul Barrows?
Yes. Yes. We would have very candid conversations with lunch about the amount of diversity that I saw on campus, how I saw other students of color reacting to it. Because for me, coming to Madison, as far as from my high school, there was no culture shock there. There were only two black people in my high school, me and Jeremiah, my best friend. You know what I mean? It was just me and him, and that was it.
Yeah.
And so coming to Madison, there wasn't any sort of, but people who move into Wisconsin from out of the state, it can be a major, major deal. And I've seen people emotionally break down and not be able to go to their classes because they don't feel welcome. And it's not that people are saying something to them or anything like that, but just the in general attitude, they don't feel welcome. And so they go into classes and they're very intimidated.
Is it because of the numbers?
It's because of the sheer numbers of white students on this campus. I mean, you walk to class every day, and let's say I walk in between like the 12 and 12:50, like during that time when everyone is on the streets, you're surrounded by about 3,000 or 4,000 white people. Now, if you come from an area where you've only grown up with black people your whole life, you're scared. This is an absolute culture shock going on. And so a lot of retention, a lot of failures in retention happen because of that reason. You can't get adjusted. You don't have a community. And you feel naked walking around. You feel like people are looking at you because everyone else's face looks the same to them, but is completely different than yours. And you would go whole days without seeing black faces. Not a single one. No one walking around. Maybe an athlete. Maybe. But usually not. And so that sort of adjustment in coming to UW-Madison is tough.
Yeah.
And making that adjustment.
But not as tough for you, in a sense.
Not as tough for me.
School, although you came from a town that was 50%.
Yeah, that was highly diversified. But I also grew up with my mom and my mom's whole side of the family, and they're all white. So for me, it wasn't an issue being comfortable around a large number of white people.
Well, did you have any problems with things like hate speech, what they call hate speech, things like any kind of discriminatory remarks made toward you or anything like that?
You'd, especially living in the dorms. So coming into the dorms, I was people's first black experience. Because kids coming to Wisconsin, I mean, if you're coming from basically north, south, east, or west of here, it's a rural community. You know what I mean? And especially if you're coming from way up north. And if you come from a town where you've never met a black person before, you get comments like, oh, I didn't know you people were so nice. And now, that's a racially biased comment, but it's not negative.
It's meant to be. It's meant to be a nice comment, but it's insensitive.
Exactly. And so that sort of insensitivity and ignorance runs rampant. That happens all the time. That sort of thing happens. But people coming up to my face and yelling a racial slur, burning a cross on my lawn, nothing like that ever happens.
Do you? What do you think now that you've had a few more years since your conversation with David Ward? You said increased numbers bring more African Americans to campus. Do you think that he's correct and that the battleship is starting to turn? And if so, what can be done besides bringing more blacks in to make it turn faster? Or is it just a slow process?
I think it's just a slow process. Really, when you're dealing with an institution that's been around for, 150 years, you know what I mean? Like, you have inside the institution ideas that are hard pressed to change.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And they may be as simple as, I don't think black kids can make the cut.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And if black kids haven't made the cut in the past, all of a sudden you have a racial bias towards black kids not making the cut. And so you keep thinking that year after year. Mm-hmm. And changing things like that just happens, I think, over generations with the country. And so those sort of changes. Now, pure number changes, I'm still kind of the opinion, why don't we just go get more students? You know, let's just make a full-out 100% effort to go get more students. But I know everyone in the university doesn't feel that way. And I also know this university isn't a dictatorship, you know, whereas you can't just put the hammer down and say, well, we're just going to go get them. And so I see more black faces now than I have any other year. And every year it has been that same way. It has been increasing. And so that's really all I can ask for, because we still live in Wisconsin. You know, this isn't California.
Right.
This isn't New York. This isn't we don't have large major urban metropolis in this state. And so there's no city grounds for minorities to live in. And rural farming communities in this nation are, especially in the north, are mostly white. And so that sort of change, the numbers changing happen, as far as like us having the lowest diversity population in the Big Ten, we're also Wisconsin, the only state that doesn't have a real city, you know? And so changes like that will eventually happen. And I think that the attitude now is more towards a diverse education being a better education. That sort of connection, I think, has been made and people feel that way. But the actual number rise, I mean, 20, 40, 60 years it'll take.
You know, so you're sort of saying two things, and you're not contradicting each other. You're saying, in a way, you'd just like to get more students in here, but you're also seeing the longer view now, that this is not probably something that's going. Do you feel good about what Wiley and Ward and Wiley have tried to do in that?
Yes, I definitely. And Wiley, I just knew him as the provost, and that's a different job than the chancellor. Yeah. The chancellor was, especially Chancellor Ward, was huge on higher education and where higher education is going and how to make higher education into a better place. And so we would talk a lot about what's going on in your classes. He always wanted to know. He's like, what's going on in your classes? How are your teachers teaching? You know, is there any subject area that everybody is finding very, very difficult? Because he wanted to change the way that those things are taught. So he was very focused on higher education as a whole. And then he was also very focused on changing the diverse nature of this campus. And I feel that Chancellor Wiley moves in that same sort of fold, moves in that same direction as Chancellor Boardman.
So he was not just listening, but he was hearing.
Yes, exactly, yeah. Exactly.
One more question. What about the Multicultural Center? Was that a place on campus that you and other scholars spent time at?
Now, before it got moved to the Red Gym,
when it was in the Union.
In the Union, I didn't see it. I didn't go there. I didn't know who was there.
Any particular reason?
No, just the burden of classes and dealing with this freedom, this newfound freedom that I had never really had. Because my parents, I wouldn't say they were overprotective or anything, but I had a curfew, and I knew kids who didn't have a curfew, and I had a curfew, which sounds reasonable to me now at being 17, but when I was 17, it was ridiculous, I thought. And so I was adjusting to, well, I can stay out till 3 in the morning if I want to, and, you know, things like that. And then there's the whole partying atmosphere that goes on here that takes away from studying and all the downtime that you tend to have in college. Like, I had no idea I would have so much free time. Because if I go to class 4 hours a day, and let's say I study for 3 or 4 hours a day, and I sleep for 8 hours a day, I have an 8-hour chunk now where I have nothing to do. And so that, adjusting to that sort of time was tough.
Yeah.
But it got done.
Yeah.
You know?
And then you learned it became easier every year as you adjusted to your freedom.
Yeah, you
got
your flow.
When the Multicultural Center moved to the Red Gym, then you started going more often?
Well, then the facilities were so wonderful there. Like, you could go in there, and finding a place to study on this campus is not an easy thing to do. Because you go to some place like College Library or Memorial Library, packed all the time, especially during the time when you really need to study. And I lived studying in the dorms is really something that doesn't happen. That's kind of a myth, because you have a roommate coming in and out all the time. Eventually you get to know a lot of the people around you and on your floor, and so everyone's just popping in and out. It's like you have 70 different roommates now all of a sudden that know you and coming out of your room and things like that.
Excuse me for interrupting, but I found when I was in college, and I know of a lot of other people, those BS sessions were oftentimes as important as classes
as
and everything else
in
terms of the growth factor
as
a person. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
But as when they opened up that center in the Red Gym, you could go there and get a computer whenever, at any time. It was open, great hours. It was nice in there. Not to say that, like, College Library isn't nice. It is nice. And not to say that Steenbach isn't nice. It is really posh in there. Like, they really set it up. All the chairs are nice and comfortable. You have your own lamp all the time. There are big tables to spread out your work. And so the more that I was there studying, the more that I was there seeing the activities and starting to get involved in the activities, whether it be like the Black Student Union activities or, in general, Richard Davis's Tuesday coffee talk kind of things. All those things started to become a bigger play when I started to go to the Red Gym more often. So
you were seeing not only Chancellor Scholarship Program African Americans, but you were seeing the more general population through these different, just the meetings, the informal meetings, and then the different events that took place. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So you would say that is now playing a very important role, at least, or did play in your your years.
And when I was here, and it's a later on, it also made me more aware, like this whole situation about when I was talking about Black students who come here from other cities, other major urban cities, and then come here and have this culture shock, I didn't know that was going on until I was a junior. Like, I was completely unaware of the people. And then as I started going to that junior year, I was in the Red Gym more, and I would talk to people, and people would break down crying about what their experiences were. And mine was completely different from that. But I could see how that could happen if you didn't know what Wisconsin had to offer you, you know?
That's interesting. It's very interesting. Some of the other social things. Didn't you have a reception every spring?
Yeah.
Or don't you at the Chancellor's Residence? Talk about
that
for a minute.
And what was nice as a freshman and sophomore was it was still at the Chancellor's Residence. As the program grew, we grew beyond the Chancellor's Residence. We couldn't we couldn't fit everyone in his house. But that freshman and sophomore year, I got to go to his house for that reception, see where he lived, you know, meet his wife. Personal level relationship things where I wouldn't have gotten that chance without the Chancellor Scholarship Program. And it's a chance to, you dress up, all the mentors are there, awards are given away. It's a graduation reception as well, because that graduating class, all of them talk about their experience in the program, talk about what they're going to do next, how they're moving on. And you get to intermingle with students in the Chancellor Scholarship, both below you and above you. Now my junior year, we moved that to the Pyle Center, down on Langdon Street.
On Langdon, the new one, relatively new one, by the
that
way.
That was beautiful as well, and we'd always have food there, and gave us a chance to have some camaraderie in a dressed up sort of setting, which is also an experience you don't get a whole lot in college.
Right.
You can go through without a reason to dress up for 4 years, you know.
So you would dress up and would you
just
wear
a tie and a shirt, something as simple like that, some nice pants and some shoes, you know, it feels good.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Um, in terms of the friends you've made on campus, are most of them from the scholarship program, or are some of them from other areas? How does that work out?
I found that...
How important is the scholarship program in this particular...
It's very important. My friends that I know now in my, I'm done with my fifth year in Madison, were either live with me in the dorms or were in the Chancellor Scholarship Program. Otherwise, like, the friends that I've had, they haven't come from any other area. It's been those two areas, because it's living in the dorms and it's the people you're with every day, and you know, you find your group of five or six and you stay with them for the whole time. And then it's the Chancellor Scholarship Program people that you see all the time, over and over again. And I would always find that in the McNair Scholars Program, there would be Chancellor Scholars in it. You know what I mean? So you would make connections in the different things that you did, and you would see other Chancellor Scholars there, and it would be those people that you made that extra connection with within the Chancellor Scholarship Program that you would continue to be friends with.
That's great. I think somebody mentioned to me that occasionally the Chancellor Scholars would go to plays in Chicago and things like that. What kind of experiences did you have in that area?
Well, the one time we all went together, oh no, twice, because we saw Rent in Madison too. We did two plays, and it was once every other year because she also runs the Powers Knapp program. So the year the Chancellor Scholars wasn't going to a play altogether, all the Powers Knapp Scholars were going to a play altogether. And so first we all went down to Chicago and saw Phantom, which was wonderful. And I had been to major musicals before, but I had never seen Phantom of the Opera, so it just blew me out of the water. And then last year we saw Rent together at the Civic Center, which was also great. And so those sort of interactions, you don't talk as much with the other scholars, but you're there in mass. And like being somewhere in mass, like all of us walking down State Street and going into the Civic Center, I mean, it's quite a sight. It's 100, 150 African-American, Asian, Native American students all together going into a place. You know, you don't see that often in Wisconsin, at least. The Chicago trip was nice. I liked going down to Chicago and seeing a play. I wouldn't have gotten that opportunity otherwise, or it was just something I wouldn't have spent the money and gone and done.
And it's a shared experience. That's the other thing. You guys have all been through this together, the plays together, and when you do meet in another context, it gives you an additional point of reference of something to. That's good. Interesting. Now, what about community involvement? Did you guys do anything in with the community?
Each class is required once a year to have a community service project and complete it as a class. And so through that, I've done University Pals. I don't know if you're
familiar. No, tell me about that.
Big Brothers and Big Sisters has a large waiting list, I guess, like hundreds of kids long waiting for a Big Brother or a Big Sister. So what University Pals does is it takes those kids off that waiting list and does things with them once a week as a group. And what we did was one of the people in the Chancellor Scholarship Program was actually running the University Pals program. And so we would meet up with her and then go and take all these kids somewhere, be it to the zoo, or one time we just kind of met outside of Lakeshore and did these art projects for an entire day out down by the lake and things like that. And I did that for 2 years. And then what's the major run called in Madison?
Oh, the Crazy Legs?
Crazy Legs, yeah. We worked for Crazy Legs 1 year, and then we also, we went down to a shelter and fed. I think it was the Salvation Army, actually, on East Wash, and made meals. And so it was that sort of, and that's all set up by class. And so each class sets it up. And then we also had the Campbell Soup Label Collection program for the... it was a Native American.
Well, somebody listening in 35 years might have no idea what you're talking about. What is the Campbell Soup?
Okay. So Campbell's put up this offer, and it's fairly crazy, but if you get like somewhere around the range of 4 million labels, 4 million Campbell's soup labels, you get a free van from Campbell's.
Oh, really?
So a full brand new 15 passenger van for whatever the program is. And so it was a small Native American college in Nebraska, I want to say.
Could be.
Or something, something like that, Montana, somewhere around there. And we would, Mercile just presented this to us as a sophomore. I was a sophomore, I think, the first year it started. And she gave us the goal of trying to collect 100 labels in a year, each scholar. So each scholar tries to collect 100 labels. And it's not, it feels like you want to eat 100 cans of soup within a year, and you don't eat with 100 cans of soup within a year, but like, as soon as you call your parents back home, and I, like, I'd say to my mom, hey, I need some soup labels. Do you have any? And she collects them from her friends.
Sure.
And you get this soup label web tree going
on. Put a little
on.
Notice in the church bulletin or something.
Yeah, exactly.
All
and all of a sudden you have 100 labels
in,
or you have 200 labels. And I'm not sure how much total we sent to the college. It was probably 20 or 30,000 or something like that total. And they got their van
they
last
did.
Year. Yeah.
Oh,
and so that was, it was a good project that was, you could see where things were going. It also required, Mercile likes to set up committees to do things because there's so much to do within the Chancellor Scholarship Program.
Right.
And there was a soup label committee, and that requires a certain amount of leadership. And she likes to set up these small leadership positions that entail you for moving on. Mm-hmm. Like each class needs to have a co-chair. And the two co-chairs just organize the activities for the class, basically, and run the monthly meetings, things like that.
Okay.
And so I got the opportunity to be there, and you vote on who's going to be the co-chair. And I got the opportunity to be the co-chair as a sophomore. And the experience helped me in my dealings with people in the lab, actually, because you learn to organize time really well as a co-chair. So we need to do, during this meeting, we need to do this, this, and this, and it needs to take this, this, and this amount of time. And all of a sudden I'm going in the lab, and I'm like, well, I've got this, this, and this to do today. It needs to take this, this, and this amount of time. And it's the same sort of organizational skills. And then as you move on, especially in the lab, like as an undergraduate in the lab, you're doing grunt work and you don't really know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
As a graduate student, you're also doing grunt work, but it's your project grunt work under somebody else. Above being a graduate student, when you move on into postdoc and having your own lab, it's less that you're at the bench and it's more that you're managing people.
Mm-hmm.
You're managing people to get done that research project that you need to get done. You're applying for million-dollar grants from the government and things of that fact to keep your lab running. And it's those kind of skills, working with people, that I feel Mercile helped me hone, at least, or sowed the seeds of when I was a sophomore and I became a co-chair for that Chancellor Scholars Group.
So when Mercile sees the need, she will form a committee, she will sign a committee to do whatever needs
whatever
to be done. And then there are these established committees, like the are there any other established committees besides the class committees?
Well, there's always, every year there's a committee for every program. So there's a committee for the picnic.
Okay.
And there's a committee for the spring reception. And there's a committee for, we had this thing towards the end of the year called the ethnic dance. And so she took advantage of the diversity of the group and asked anyone from the group who knew any sort of cultural dance from anywhere, you know, from any of your background, come on in and do it. And we'll all get together and have a good time. And so there would be, oh, I think we met in the field house the first time. And we had punch and cookies and danced for like an hour and a half and learned all these number of different dances. Like there was this girl from Vietnam taught us this Vietnamese dance, and then we all did the electric slide together. I mean,
what's
it
the
was,
electric slide?
It's just a, I don't know. It's a line dance. It's a country.
Oh,
it's a country line dance,
country
basically.
Line dance,
but it's a popular hip hop sort of dance that everybody just does together whenever you're in the club. And so, I mean, that sort of thing. And it was that, those experiences were wonderful.
So these again are community building experiences.
Yes.
And this is why you're saying that there was so much of your time was focused on the Chancellor Scholarship Program. So it's obviously not just an academic
program. No. And even, especially the academic component as far as the grades, is a very minor part of it. I would say the more important academic part is meeting your mentor and who you meet through that mentor to connect this university into yourself. Mm-hmm. Because you can do anything here. This is a university of the size where whatever you can think of to do, more than likely someone here is doing it and doing it very well.
Mm-hmm.
You just need to have that foot in to meet that person and interact for the first time with that person. And so,
well, the name that keeps popping up, of course, is Mercile. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit now. You knew her at first and she had kind of laid out the rules right away. Talk about how your relationship with her has developed over the years and give me some insight into Mercile as the head of this program.
She, right away, I got the impression, even from the first meeting, that And it was negative at first.
Right, because of the
because of what she said about the medical school thing. And also, I got the impression that she was trying to be my mother.
Ah.
And I have a mother. You know what I mean? I came to college to, especially when I was 18, to stop listening to what people said to me, you know? And
especially parents.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that whole parental figure was now gone. Yeah. I didn't need a new one in place. And so there was an initial, and I think with a lot of students this happens with Mercio, mm-hmm. there's an initial butting of heads, so to say. Because, and I've learned this time and time again, Mercio knows better. She knows better than you do.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it is that you're doing, if you're from the ages of 18 to 22, she knows better than you do. Now, you may not like to hear that, mm-hmm. just like I didn't like to hear that. I really, really didn't like to hear that. But she knows, like, she can look at, she'd look at my grades, and she'd say, a 3-2, you're not even trying very hard, are you? And it would floor me, you know, because I had always thought, like, 3-2, you know, that's, yeah, I'm doing fine. You know, everyone's happy with 3-2. I'm still in my scholarship program. And she would just say, what's the matter? Are you not being challenged? Like, she would ask me questions like that, directed questions where she knew something was wrong, even though on the outside, like, it doesn't appear there's something going wrong here, you know. But she has that motherly instinct where she cares about each and every one of her students personally and academically.
Mm-hmm.
So she has to combine the two, because a lot of the times, you know, we do things that she doesn't like, you know, and we have social habits that she doesn't like, or social habits that she doesn't approve of, but she knows how to keep us on the right track. Mm-hmm. Like, she knows where to push. And it is a pushing kind of thing with an 18 to 22 year old, mm-hmm. I think. Like, you can't, it's that age where it's a hard time to deal with your brain. You don't know what's going on. You're having all these new experiences coming at you. There's no mother and father there to buffer those things off of. And Mercio can act personally, as at least with my case, individually.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard this from other Chancellor Scholars as well, that she can act personally as a buffer toward what comes to you. And you don't bring all your problems to Mercio, but I know a lot of people who have brought a lot of issues to Mercio that were completely non-academic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just within her experience, she knows what goes on. And especially here, especially at UW-Madison, she...
Mercio knows what you're going through,
mm-hmm.
and she talks about it.
She has an individual interest, or a very personal interest, in what you're doing at all times.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be hard.
Yeah.
You know, because you don't want someone to have that much interest in you. You don't want someone to know what's going on or ask you questions like, are you getting enough sleep?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, having a person ask you that at an individual level, like, I'm used to my mom asking me that question, or how do you feel today?
Mm-hmm.
Or, like, you can talk to Mercio over the phone, she's like, you sound like you have a cold. Do you have a cold? You know, she knows each one of us on that sort of individual level, where, I mean, I give her a hug every time I see her. Like, it isn't, there's no question about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the relationship that we have. And so...
So you begin to appreciate that honesty.
Yeah, and especially in her position, because the amount of work that she does, and I really just started to learn this towards the end, because I started to work a lot more with the Chancellor Scholarship Program. Like, I was on every committee. I was doing everything. I was in Mercio's office at least 3 or 4 times a month doing something or another. And so towards the end, I was seeing her a whole lot and seeing what she does, and the number of students that she has. And 125, 150 can feel like a small number at a university of 40,000, but to have a personal invested interest in each one of those students, and I know it's the same way over on the Powers Knapp side as well,
mm-hmm.
there's probably 200 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so to have that sort of interest and that sort of knowledge about that number of students, along with all the administrative things that she has to do within the program, along with getting grant money and getting money for the program from both personal donors and donors coming from corporations, and writing recommendation letters. I mean, she has to write a ridiculous number of recommendation letters each year, because she knows us on an individual level. So everyone, Mercio had nothing, like, she didn't have a working knowledge of my scientific background. And I asked her for a recommendation letter for graduate school. It was unquestioned. I wanted her to be one of the people writing my recommendation letters for graduate school in biomedical science.
Mm-hmm.
It's something she has no connection with whatsoever. I mean, no one's going to look, I mean, besides her being a vice chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, she has no connection to science. But
I knew as a character, she knew who I was.
And she could look into your soul.
Yeah, exactly. She knew exactly who I was. Yeah. And a lot of Chancellor scholars feel that exact same mm-hmm. way. And so I really can't say enough about Mercia. It really, every time she doesn't cease to, she gets 3 hours of sleep a night. Mm-hmm. And that's what she's used to. And that's what she does. And that sort of work ethic in itself yeah. just is a beacon of light when you're yeah. looking for why I should get up and do my homework. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Like, well, it's an inspiration.
Yeah, exactly. It's that sort of mentoring relationship that she puts out without even any sort of words, mm-hmm. just like in her actions every day.
Does she meet with the students individually mm-hmm. a certain number of times a semester?
It's once a semester you have to meet with Mercia mm-hmm. individually. And I know, and I've even been that way, that strikes fear in your heart at sometimes.
Yeah, I can understand.
Sometimes
that, yeah.
you go in and things are great and you sit and you chat and an hour and a half has gone by and you didn't even know. Yeah. Like, it felt like you were in there for 15 minutes. It's like talking with a really old friend who really yeah. knows who you yeah. are. And at other times you go in there and it is like pulling teeth. Because it's like talking with your mother. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, I mean, they care to the point where, let's say one semester I got a 2.75. Things just kind of slipped off the deep end academically. I went under, my cumulative GPA was still well over the 3.0, mm-hmm. but for this one semester of time, like, things just went poorly and I didn't really have any excuses. And I went into her and we had this pulling teeth conversation about what I was doing mm-hmm. and what's going wrong here, you know, are you going to get back on track and things of that effect. And it was exactly what I needed, yeah. you know, it's exactly that kind of pushing that I needed. Because, I mean, your parents get sent your grades in the mail, maybe, you know, mm-hmm. and otherwise after freshman year, they don't ever see them. And so you're on your own at this university and it's very large. And when you have someone looking out for you like that, mm-hmm. I'm not saying I wouldn't have made it through
mm-hmm. right, but
without her. And I'm not saying that I may even be along the same career path, mm-hmm. but as a person, without her, the changes that I've made maturity-wise, the changes mm-hmm. that I've made in my academic stance on things and the way I approach academia, there's no question that she has affected my life here at the university.
Well, you said that when you went in there with your 2.75, you really kind of got it. And you said in other times, and you need it to mm-hmm. get it, and other times you had these nice long conversations. Perhaps could it be that that's maybe what she thought you needed and deserved at that point too?
See, then this is true. You don't know what's going on in Mercio's mind mm-hmm. as far as when you're talking with her. Like, she has very, very long-reaching sight, I would say. Mm-hmm. Because right after she told me I didn't want to be a medical doctor, she said, I think you want to go get your PhD and become a tenured professor somewhere. Mm-hmm. Now that's exactly what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And for the next 8 to 10 years of my life, that is my mm-hmm. goal. And it's fairly locked in stone. Mm-hmm. But for her to say something to me, I mean, I don't know where she saw that yeah. from. I don't know where she got that from at all.
It's almost like a second sight.
Yeah, yeah. It's a strange sort of, and I know that everybody is not comfortable hearing things like yeah. that, you know what I mean? And there could be times when maybe she's been off with people, I don't know. But 9 times out of 10, I would say, at least with the scholars that I've talked to, have had that same sort of relationship.
Do you feel like she's in your corner?
Oh, unquestionably, in every area, especially being a minority on this campus. Mm-hmm. And she stresses to you that she's in your corner, but you also need to be in right. hers. And that sort of connection is the only way to make things better at this university mm-hmm. as far as diversity is concerned. Because if you're entrenched in an affirmative action program, like the Chancellor Scholars is, and then not backing affirmative action in your policy, you know what I mean? If mm-hmm. you're making that sort of flip, then you're not understanding the way things are working and the way things are going on. And so she stressed, and she didn't stress things like this in meetings. This mm-hmm. is what, in the whole meetings. This is things that we've talked about on mm-hmm. an individual mm-hmm. basis, where your practice and your policy need to go hand in hand. And like, what you do and how you do it, and then also what your beliefs are and how they are expressed need to be a commingling kind of thing. And it's those kind of conversations that I've had with Mercia that I mean, it was amazing that she told me I should go get my PhD, and she was right on the money. But it was those kind of conversations that have helped me along the most, I think, as far as maturity.
Were you at the 15th anniversary thing?
Mm-hmm.
What were your feelings at that moment when they snookered Mercil? Yeah. Which isn't an easy thing to do,
exactly.
I would imagine.
Nothing.
I think it was Chancellor Shane who didn't he? Somebody got up and made the presentation.
Mm-hmm. And she didn't know anything was coming.
She knew, and I've talked to her about that. She said she knew nothing.
Yeah, I knew before.
Everybody knew. She said everybody knew. That she said, I can't believe that I didn't know.
And keeping it a secret from her, because she is who she is, she'll read it out of you.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
She'll draw that right out of you, and she didn't. That reception was wonderful, because I didn't know how many people Mercil had touched. You know what I mean? Because it was just like my class, and then class below me, and a couple classes above me. But I didn't know the broad range of people. And then the people that were there speaking, I mean, it was like a who's who of University of Wisconsin,
yes,
you know? Just like over and over and over again, and you start to build this picture in your mind that you are in the presence of a wonderful woman. You're just,
it is a who's who.
Yeah.
I have the brochure for the program, and it's going to be in Omai's folder, so anybody listening to this can look at it and see exactly what he's talking about. So it must have been quite a thrill when she got that feeling.
It was amazing. It was amazing.
Yeah. Are there any other people? You said, I talked to you on the phone the other day, and I said, did you work with Marion Brown at all? Marion does a lot of fundraising and whatnot for the program in the foundation. And you said you really didn't have much association with her.
There's this, and the only reason that I got to know this is because of the extended work that I've done with Mercil in the past couple of years. I know most of the other scholars don't get this sort of inner workings of the program, but there's the program and the kids, I mean, and the college students and how they're all doing their whole life and all the mentors. And then there's this huge other money funding side. Mm-hmm. And that other money funding side is where Marion is.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would always see Marion at the picnic, you know, and say hi. And like, I had that sort of acquaintance with Marion, but I never, like, she wasn't at the monthly meetings or things to that effect. That's not her aspect of it. But when I started to get more involved in the fundraising, because Mercil would ask me to meet with donors, and so I would go out and have I would go out and have dinner with a private donor, with Mercil and Marion, and we would talk about the program, kind of like we're talking about the program now. And just, I mean, it is selling the program to people, but it's that fundraising activity that keeps the program alive. And having those sort of conversations with donors, I got to see Mercil's effect on people who have no connection with the program and the way she presented it. Now, I can present it I feel I present the program in a very personal way because it's the way it has touched me.
Mm-hmm.
But the way Mercil presents the program.
Tell me how she presents the program.
Oh, and it's not, and see, I got to see it with people who were already donors. So I've never seen her present the program to new donors. But talking about it with old, it's just this passion about the program where, like, all right, so I'm going to make another science comparison here because that's just kind of how I am. I want to spend my life studying one very, very, very small thing and know a whole lot about it. And that's going to be my passion. Mercil's passion is the Chancellor Scholarship Program. And every time she talks about it, you see that coming out of her. That she loves it. She lives and she breathes it. And that's...
Do you think the donors sense that enthusiasm
and passion? I think they see that, and I don't know. I've never been able to say no to Mercil, and that's not. If Mercil asks me to do something, I do it, and that's just. It's as simple as that. It's as simple as that, and it's not just respect or anything. It's just like, it's like a good friend asking you, well, "Why don't you do me this favor?" And you're like, "Of course I will."
Yeah.
You know, and I feel that's the same kind of relationship that the donors get from, you know, Mercil, like, presents her whole program, and they see everything that's involved, and she gets what she needs.
Yeah.
She gets the money that she needs.
Is there anyone else that on the staff or whatnot, besides Mercil and Marion, who are associated with the program that you've worked with? Or is that pretty much it?
It's not pretty. There's always been someone in the office,
because it
requires a large amount of paperwork.
There's
a large amount of paperwork that goes on, and so I would have interactions with those people as well, but majorly it's been
In a lot of ways, this is Mercil's program.
It is.
Could I'm just sort of a worst-case scenario. I mean, Merceel's going to leave someday.
This
you know,
is true.
That just happens in life,
yeah.
unfortunately, and hopefully it won't be for a long, long while.
Mm-hmm.
But is this program Merceel-specific? Do you think it would be able to continue?
Well, it has. Initially, I definitely think it was. Like, when they were just starting out and there were only five chancellors.
Right, the first class was five.
Yeah, and Merceel was fighting for money and fighting the university to get the program. And, you know, and just things like that. It was hers. And now, it's still hers, but it's grown beyond.
Bigger than her in the
sense? Yeah, it's gotten a higher, because it represents, at this university, I feel the retention within the program and the graduation rates within the program and things like that are just sky high. Mm. Sky high in all areas. And it has the chancellor's name attached to it, which I think is very important. I think it can move beyond, and it definitely will move beyond when Merceel leaves. Now, getting someone to do what Merceel does, I don't know if you can pay someone enough money to do what Merceel does. You know, I think that may require two or three people.
Yeah.
And so when she does leave, I don't think it'll be a single person replacing her. But when she does leave, I can see it being a chancellor scholar who replaces her.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. That would make perfect sense.
Yeah, or someone like that connected in the program or a longtime donor. And there are a lot of anonymous donors. There are a lot of donors. You have no idea who it is at all. And, I mean, Merceel knows. But, I mean, as students and things like that, we have no idea. And so there are a lot of people involved with the program. I mean, I don't think it'll be, you won't put an ad out for Merceel's job. You know, you can't do that. And so.
Yeah, and the person who would eventually come in does not have to be, probably shouldn't try to be.
Yeah, well,
I mean, when you replace Vince Lombardi as coach, you have to come in and you have to be yourself.
You can't fill those shoes.
You can't try to pretend that you're Vince Lombardi because you're not.
And it's going to be hardest, I feel, for the people who started with Merceel but didn't get to finish with
him. Yeah.
You know, and that's sort of like, if you're like a junior and Merceel has to leave, oh, that would be bad.
If you could, what do you think is the major strength of the program?
Merceel, first of all. Merceel's undying attention, just determination that A, have this program work, B, have everyone within it be excelling. That's what she's looking for, is excellence in every category from all the scholars. And then it's the scholars themselves, I think. She puts together a wonderful group of people. Like, that's just, she does a great job putting together a diverse group that can succeed, can get along with each other. And these are things, like, you take for granted. Like, I had never really interacted with a Native American person before the Chancellor Scholarship Program. And, like, that sort of racial divide can have complications in a relationship with a person, but there's never a question when you're with Merceel and within the program. You know everything is going to be great. You know everything is going to work out, and you're not going to become friends with everybody, but you're going to be friendly acquaintances with everybody, of course, you know? And so that sort of, the strength of the scholars and the strength of Merceel, and then the unquestionable backing of the program from the university. Like, there's never...
You feel that they're there.
Because everybody comes in to talk. Like, I got to see, within my first year, Chancellor Ward, Provost Wiley, and Mary Rouse.
Mm-hmm.
All three of those people, who were like the highest of the high, and as far as an undergraduate is concerned, came to talk to us on a candid level. And then she would bring in other people, like Richard Davis would come in to talk, and things like that. And we would have, somebody came in and gave a slide presentation on the history of the university, which, things I would know absolutely nothing about.
Is that Art Hovey by any chance?
Yeah,
I know Art,
And it was things I had no idea. I had absolutely no idea that they were farming out at Picnic Point, and now we have all these trees, you know? And the way that Bascom Hill and Capitol Hill had all this sort of intermingling co-play go on. Things that
the relationship between the university and the state symbolized by this.
You wouldn't learn that unless you took a class on that, you know? And we would have all this opportunity. And so, combined with Merceel, the scholars, and the support from the university, like, everything locks together. Merceel's the clue, though. I mean,
if there were any suggestions you would make to improve or strengthen, let me say strengthen rather than improve, strengthen the program, what would it be? Any suggestion?
Strengthening the program, that's tough. This program's very strong. Like, especially, well, I did have a very positive
You don't
experience.
Have to, this doesn't demand an answer.
Another Murcio, I guess.
Well, maybe additional help, is that what you're saying?
Oh, well, additional help would always be, if you could take some of the workload off of her and move it on to somebody else who cared and did as much, like, that would help. But you never feel, you can always get in to see Murcio.
Mm-hmm.
She always has time for you. Always. You can even just, like, walk into the office, you know, and unless she's directly in a meeting or going to a meeting, she always has time to sit in a meeting. She prioritizes her time that way, that if a scholar comes in, that's where the time priority lies. And so, if you could open up more time for her to do that, I guess, maybe. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really can't see an improvement on the program because everything is the mentors. The mentors are all just wonderful. Like, they really, really care about the program, and they get the opportunity or the advantage of only having one student to care for. Like, Murcio has to try and care for every student. And so that sort of relationship, give the program more money.
That's more people, more money. I mean, this is your chance to say. Maybe I'll send a copy up to the chancellor and have him listen to it.
More donations. Yeah.
You're going away to college in a few days. Mm-hmm. You came in today, and we're conducting this interview. It's now 6:30 in the evening, and you have a summer job.
Mm-hmm.
Just very briefly, in 30 seconds to a minute, give me a summary of what you've been doing this summer for.
I've done fairly hardcore science for the last 3 summers, and it's paid very well, but it's, I don't have a break.
Mm-hmm.
I go summer, school year,
mm-hmm.
science all the way through. And so I graduated in December,
mm-hmm.
and I spent that first chunk of time, that first semester, being a pizza man. And I wasn't delivering pizzas, I was making pizzas.
Right.
So I was rolling out pizzas at Fauble Brothers and sending them on their way. And I had had jobs like that before, like in high school and things like that, and just it wasn't what I was looking for all summer. And so I started to look for employment, and I had no idea what I wanted to go into. And a friend of mine that I had met in the dorms freshman year, we're talking about friendship circles kind of thing, he said, well, the summer camp I'm working for needs a person. Do you have any experience with children? And I was like, no, but I have 11 nieces and nephews that I've spent a lot of time around, and I taught Sunday school when I was in high school. Does that count? And he's like, oh yeah, it's more than enough. So I became a camp counselor for Camp Shalom Noir, it's called. It's out in Verona, and it was 6th through 9th graders.
Mm.
And what we would do, my first 3-week session, I had 6th graders. We would take a 15-passenger van and take them anywhere we wanted in the state, basically. As long as we were back to the campus by 4 o'clock, back to that place in Verona. 4 o'clock. So we went to Blue Mound State Park, Governor Dodge State Park, all places I had never been before in my whole time in Wisconsin. So that sort of experience was great. And then I had 9th graders, second session, and we got to go on a 4-day camping trip in Peninsula State Park in Door County, which another thing that was absolutely beautiful. And then going to school with, when you go and you work with children, and even 9th graders, they were still, I mean, they're 13, they're
mm-hmm.
still children.
Mm-hmm.
It's just kind of like simple grin I seem to get on my face in the morning. It doesn't really fade all day, no matter what they do, just because they're so different from what I've been doing. And now this last session, I worked the younger kids camp, and I have 5-year-olds every day. They are going to be kindergartners next year.
Wow.
And the joy of doing that work really makes me want to continue volunteering when I move to San Diego. This 3-week experience with 5-year-olds, because you go to work, and there are times where you go to work in the sciences and you can go an entire 3 or 4 days where nothing works. Absolutely
mm-hmm.
nothing
mm-hmm.
works. Anything that you do is just right down the drain. But with 5-year-olds, if you give them a smile and a yell, they always yell, they always get happy from that. Like, I don't know, it's hard to express the joy I get from these 5-year-old mm-hmm. kids when I see them, but it would be nice to continue on in that sort of thing when I know getting my PhD in that really don't go hand in hand.
Well, we were talking beforehand, and you said that you were leaving for San Diego, which impressed me immensely because I've lived in that area myself and know just how wonderful it is. But how did you end up, how is it that you ended up going to San Diego?
Well, it's
UCSD, right?
Yeah, UCSD. I applied for graduate schools the following year, I mean the previous year in the fall.
Right.
And I applied. Well, I knew I wanted to move out west. I was tired of Wisconsin from there. I had 22 in a row, and I was ready to leave. And so I applied to UCLA, UC San Diego, University of Wisconsin, and University of Michigan. Whereas, I didn't know I was going to get into Wisconsin or Michigan, but I knew I was competitive. I knew going into graduate school that I had, it wasn't like high school where I knew I could get in wherever I wanted. Now it was more, because it's an upper level sort of thing.
Tougher.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I knew I had a competitive application in all areas. And so I got into all four of those schools. And the joy of graduate school, or as opposed to the professional schools, is they pay for you to come see their school once you get in because you've made the cut. That cut to get in is like 10% of all applications. Now they really want you to come to school here. And so they wine you and they dine you and they fly you out for 4 days. Like I got to fly out to UCLA for 4 days. Fly back to Madison. The following week, fly back out to San Diego for four days. And so I got this like 8-day excursion in California.
Southern Cal.
Yeah, Southern California even, while it was March here. We had a bad March this year. This March was not very good. And I knew it was down to UCLA or UCSD. As soon as I got into those two schools, I went to the interview here, and I went to the interview at Michigan, but I knew I wasn't going to either one of these institutions. And I didn't want to live in Los Angeles.
Yeah, that's tough.
That's the image that I got when I got, because academically, the two schools are about the same. Yeah. UCLA has a bigger undergraduate population, but graduate school-wise, and what I want to go into as far as the like biomedical science field, they're both top 10 institutions. They both get a lot of money from the government, so they're well-funded. So going into whatever you want to go into isn't a problem at all. And it came down to, do you want to live in LA or do you want to live in San Diego? Which, I mean, it's not a choice everyone gets to make. And so I was like, I want to live in San Diego. And I don't want it to take 2 hours to drive across town where the town is only 45 miles, you know? And so I chose San Diego, and I still don't know quite what I'm getting myself into, because they say, how can you study when you look out your window and the beach is right there?
That's a very good question.
I don't know, but I knew as soon as I started walking around the campus at UCSD, it was kind of a right away sort of thing.
I don't know anything about their genetics program, but I sure know about it. I've been at the campus a lot, and I'm familiar with that area. Boy, it is enchanting.
Oh, it is.
It's really enchanting.
And I just was taken aback, even just by the plant life, because I've grown up here for so long, and I take all our plant life for granted, because I know what everything here looks like. Even the grass is different, you know? Yeah. Everything just has this.
And those palm trees are really funny. Weird-looking things. They're
nice.
Beautiful. Yeah.
It's nice. You go down to the beach and you see the ocean. And I grew up on Lake Michigan, so I was used to a rather large body of water as compared to Madison. But the ocean just, it sounds beautiful. You can just close your eyes and just listen to it.
Yeah.
I'm pretty excited.
Yeah, it sounds like you are. You're exactly right to be excited. You'll keep in touch with Mercil, the program?
Yeah.
How does that happen with other people you've seen? Do people come back and visit a lot?
You come into the office and there's a scholar there who you don't recognize because they are, just whenever you stop through Madison, you go see Mercia.
Yeah.
Or she has an extensive email list, just every day, 40 or 50 messages coming in, and most of them from scholars, just telling them what they're doing. I mean, even as recently as 2 weeks ago, I was talking to her about a conversation she had, a 3-hour conversation she had with a graduate student who was in her 5th year at University of Minnesota, and she was a previous Chancellor Scholar and was having some trouble. I mean, it was that sort of connection, like you can always come back to Mercil, because she always has that same sort of insight that I saw as a 19-year-old, whereas if I run into something down the road, I know she'll have something to say about it that will help me. And it's like talking to your mom. It's the same sort of thing. Like,
well, you mentioned earlier about how she knows all the scholars on campus and how impressed you are. But she knows more than the scholars on campus. She knows all the ones who have gone. And as you increase in size, it's quite astonishing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And wherever you go, she has a contact person for you there. Like, I already have 2 email addresses for people living in San Diego. One of them is even in my area who were Chancellor Scholars before. Yeah. So
that's where the networking comes in. So you're going to get the same thing out here. It's like when you went to see Paul Barrows, he's going to say, go see so-and-so. Mm-hmm. And this person's going to say, go see so-and-so. And I don't know who to look for, but she will. Yeah. Okay. Gotcha.
And it's an extended list of what it comes down to is who you know. You know, it's an extended list of who you've become acquainted with or who that you know and who that they know. Because it was that way for me going into graduate school as well. I knew Paul Burdix did his postdoc at UCSD. Mm-hmm. And when you have a recommendation letter for someone who's done their postdoc in an institution, and I got one from Dean Henshaw as well, and she did her work at UCLA. Mm-hmm. And so it's that, it's all those sort of connections that you have no idea. But.
And it doesn't hurt that she's at UC Davis right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, I'm going to go visit her when I'm down there.
Oh, that's great. Closing comments. Do you have anything you would like to say about your years at the UW and your association with the Chancellor Scholarship Program?
It's very, very special. And I'm glad I didn't go anywhere else. I'm glad I didn't make that decision to go to Stanford or to go to Brown and to miss out on my Madison experience, and especially my experience within the program, because it's going to be a lifelong thing for me. And I can even encourage my children to go to University of Wisconsin-Madison. Wherever I may live, I can tell them that's a great school and there are great people there. And I know that for a fact. Mm-hmm. So it's that sort of connection that I made here that really made this place special for me, because, I mean, again, it's a big place, a very, very big place. And for all those other freshmen coming in who don't have the advantage of the Chancellor Scholarship Program, I think it can be very, very hard to succeed. Mm-hmm. And people drop out all the time. I mean, you see it. Mm-hmm. People come from very successful careers in high school and then, you know, just become overwhelmed and can't make it here. And Mercil and the scholarship program, I mean, they've defined what I'm going to do with my life, basically. They made that connection to allow me to go on and academically and career-wise do what I want to do. And it all funnels through the program. So I couldn't say anything more.
Well, it's been great meeting you. It's been great talking to you. And I know you're not going to need a wish for success, but I'm going to wish you best of success.
Thank you very much.
Okay.